Over the next few days, Ivan had all of Andre's close associates arrested and banished. Caught off guard by his sudden boldness, the boyars now stood in mortal terror of this youth, the future Ivan the Terrible, who had planned and waited for 5 years to execute this one swift and bold act that would secure his power for decades to come. Interpretation. The world is full of boyars, men who despise you, fear your ambition, and jealously guard their shrinking realms of power. You need to establish your authority and gain respect. But the moment the boyars sense your growing boldness, they will act to thwart you. This is how Ivan met such a situation. He lay low, showing neither ambition nor discontent. He waited, and when the time came, he brought the palace guards over to his side. The guards had come to hate the cruel Shuiskis. Once they agreed to Ivan's plan, he struck with the swiftness of a snake, pointing his finger at Shuiski and giving him no time to react. Negotiate with a boyar and you create opportunities for him. A small compromise becomes the toehold he needs to tear you apart. The sudden bold move, without discussion or warning, obliterates these toeholds and builds your authority. You terrify doubters and despisers and gain the confidence of the many who admire and glorify those who act boldly. Observance number 3. In 1514, the 22-year-old Pietro Aretino was working as a lowly assistant scullion to a wealthy Roman family. He had ambitions of greatness as a writer, to inflame the world with his name. But how could a mere lackey hope to realize such dreams? That year, Pope Leo X received from the King of Portugal an embassy that included many gifts, most prominent among them a great elephant, the first in Rome since imperial times. The pontiff adored this elephant and showered it with attention and gifts. But despite his love and care, the elephant, which was called Hanno, became deathly ill. The pope summoned doctors who administered a 500-pound purgative to the elephant, but all to no avail. The animal died, and the pope went into mourning. To console himself, he summoned the great painter Raphael and ordered him to create a life-size painting of Hanno above the animal's tomb, bearing the inscription, "What nature took away, Raphael has with his art restored." Over the next few days, a pamphlet circulated throughout Rome that caused great merriment and laughter. Entitled, "The Last Will and Testament of the Elephant Hanno," it read in part, "To my heir, the Cardinal Santa Croce, I give my knees, so that he can imitate my genuflections. To my heir, Cardinal Santi Quattro, I give my jaws, so that he can more readily devour all of Christ's revenues. To my heir, Cardinal Medici, I give my ears, so that he can hear everyone's doings. To Cardinal Grassi, who had a reputation for lechery, the elephant bequeathed the appropriate, oversized part of his own anatomy." On and on the anonymous pamphlet went, sparing none of the great in Rome, not even the Pope. With each one it took aim at their best-known weakness. The pamphlet ended with verse, "See to it that Aretino is your friend, for he is a bad enemy to have. His words alone could ruin the high Pope, so God guard everyone from his tongue." Interpretation. With one short pamphlet, Aretino, son of a poor shoemaker and a servant himself, hurled himself to fame. Everyone in Rome rushed to find out who this daring young man was. Even the Pope, amused by his audacity, sought him out and ended up giving him a job in the papal service. Over the years he came to be known as the Scourge of Princes, and his biting tongue earned him the respect and fear of the great, from the King of France to the Habsburg Emperor. The Aretino strategy is simple. When you are as small and obscure as David was, you must find a Goliath to attack. The larger the target, the more attention you gain. The bolder the attack, the more you stand out from the crowd, and the more admiration you earn. Society is full of those who think daring thoughts, but lack the guts to print and publicize them. Voice what the public feels. The expression of shared feelings is always powerful. Search out the most prominent target possible and sling your boldest shot. The world will enjoy the spectacle and will honor the underdog, you, that is, with glory and power. Keys to power. Most of us are timid. We want to avoid tension and conflict, and we want to be liked by all. We may contemplate a bold action, but we rarely bring it to life. We are terrified of the consequences, of what others might think of us, of the hostility we will stir up if we dare go beyond our usual place. Although we may disguise our timidity as a concern for others, a desire not to hurt or offend them, in fact it is the opposite. We are really self-absorbed, worried about ourselves and how others perceive us. Boldness, on the other hand, is outer-directed, and often makes people feel more at ease, since it is less self-conscious and less repressed. This can be seen most clearly in seduction. All great seducers succeed through effrontery. Casanova's boldness was not revealed in a daring approach to the women he desired, or in intrepid words to flatter her. It consisted in his ability to surrender himself to her completely, and to make her believe he would do anything for her, even risk his life, which in fact he sometimes did. The woman on whom he lavished this attention understood that he held nothing back from her. This was infinitely more flattering than compliments. At no point during the seduction would he show hesitation or doubt, simply because he never felt it. Part of the charm of being seduced is that it makes us feel engulfed, temporarily outside of ourselves, and the usual doubts that permeate our lives. The moment the seducer hesitates, the charm is broken, because we become aware of the process, of their deliberate effort to seduce us, of their self-consciousness. Boldness directs attention outward and keeps the illusion alive. It never induces awkwardness or embarrassment. And so we admire the bold and prefer to be around them, because their self-confidence infects us and draws us outside our own realm of inwardness and reflection. Few are born bold. Even Napoleon had to cultivate the habit on the battlefield, where he knew it was a matter of life and death. In social settings, he was awkward and timid, but he overcame this and practiced boldness in every part of his life, because he saw its tremendous power, how it could literally enlarge a man, even one who, like Napoleon, was in fact conspicuously small. We also see this change in Ivan the Terrible. A harmless boy suddenly transforms himself into a powerful young man who commands authority, simply by pointing a finger and taking bold action. You must practice and develop your boldness. You will often find uses for it. The best place to begin is often the delicate world of negotiation, particularly those discussions in which you are asked to set your own price. How often we put ourselves down by asking for too little. When Christopher Columbus proposed that the Spanish court finance his voyage to the Americas, he also made the insanely bold demand that he be called Grand Admiral of the Ocean. The court agreed. The price he set was the price he received. He demanded to be treated with respect, and so he was. Henry Kissinger, too, knew that in negotiation, bold demands work better than starting off with piecemeal concessions and trying to meet the other person halfway. Set your value high, and then, as Count Lustig did, set it higher. Understand, if boldness is not natural, neither is timidity. It is an acquired habit, picked up out of a desire to avoid conflict. If timidity has taken hold of you, then root it out. Your fears of the consequences of a bold action are way out of proportion to reality. And in fact, the consequences of timidity are worse. Your value is lowered, and you create a self-fulfilling cycle of doubt and disaster. Remember, the problems created by an audacious move can be disguised, even remedied, by more and greater audacity. Reversal. Boldness should never be the strategy behind all of your actions. It is a tactical instrument, to be used at the right moment. Plan and think ahead, and make the final element the bold move that will bring you success. In other words, since boldness is a learned response, it is also one that you learn to control and utilize at will. To go through life armed only with audacity would be tiring and also fatal. He would offend too many people, as is proven by those who cannot control their boldness. One such person was Lola Montez. Her audacity brought her triumphs and led to her seduction of the King of Bavaria. But since she could never rein in her boldness, it also led to her downfall. In Bavaria, in England, wherever she turned, it crossed the border between boldness and the appearance of cruelty, even insanity. Yvonne the Terrible suffered the same fate. When the power of boldness brought him success, he stuck to it, to the point where it became a lifelong pattern of violence and sadism. He lost the ability to tell when boldness was appropriate and when it wasn't. Timidity has no place in the realm of power. You will often benefit, however, by being able to feign it. At that point, of course, it is no longer timidity, but an offensive weapon. You are luring people in with your show of shyness. All the better to pounce on them boldly later. Here are some further reflections on this law. From Fables by Jean de La Fontaine. The Two Adventurers. The path of pleasure never leads to glory. The prodigious achievements of Hercules were the result of high adventure, and though there is little either in fable or history to show that he had any rivals, still it is recorded that a knight-errant, in company with a fellow adventurer, sought his fortune in a romantic country. He had not traveled far when his companion observed a post on which was written the following inscription: "Brave adventurer, if you have a desire to discover that which has never been seen by any knight-errant, you have only to pass this torrent, and then take in your arms an elephant of stone, and carry it in one breath to the summit of this mountain, whose noble head seems blended with the sky." "But," said the knight's companion, "the water may be deep as well as rapid, and though, notwithstanding, we should pass it, why should we be encumbered with the elephant? What a ridiculous undertaking!" And philosophically, and with nice calculation, he observed that the elephant might be carried 4 steps. But for conveying it to the top of the mountain in one breath, that was not in the power of a mortal, unless it should be the dwarf figure of an elephant, fit only to be placed on the top of a stick. And then what honor would there be in such an adventure? "There is," said he, "some deception in this writing. It is an enigma only fit to amuse a child. I shall therefore leave you and your elephant." The reasoner then departed, but the adventurous man rushed with his eyes closed across the water. Neither depth nor violence prevented him, and according to the inscription he saw the elephant lying on the opposite bank. He took it and carried it to the top of the hill, where he saw a town. A shriek from the elephant alarmed the people of the city, who rose in arms. But the adventurer, nothing daunted, was determined to die a hero. The people, however, were awed by his presence, and he was astonished to hear them proclaim him successor to their king, who had recently died. Great enterprises are only achieved by adventurous spirits. They who calculate with too great nicety every difficulty and obstacle which is likely to lie in their way lose that time and hesitation which the more daring seize and render available to the loftiest purposes. From Baltasar Gracian. Always set to work without misgivings on the score of imprudence. Fear of failure in the mind of a performer is, for an onlooker, already evidence of failure. Actions are dangerous when there is doubt as to their wisdom. It would be safer to do nothing. Behind the Scenes of Royal Palaces in Korea by Ha Tae-hung. The Story of Hu Sang. In a lowly thatched cottage in the Namsan Valley, there lived a poor couple, Mr. and Mrs. Ho Sang. The husband confined himself for 7 years and only read books in his cold room. One day his wife, all in tears, said to him, "Look here, my good man, what is the use of all your book reading? I have spent my youth in washing and sewing for other people, and yet I have no spare jacket or skirt to wear, and I have had no food to eat during the past 3 days. I am hungry and cold. I can stand it no more." Hearing these words, the middle-aged scholar closed his book, rose to his feet, and without saying another word, he went out of doors. Arriving in the heart of the city, he stopped a passing gentleman.
"Hello, my friend. Who is the richest man in town?"
"Poor countryman, don't you know Bianchi, the millionaire? His glittering tile-roofed house, pierced by 12 gates, is just over there."
Hossein bent his steps to the rich man's house. Having entered the big gate, he flung the guest room door open and addressed the host.
"I need 10,000 yuan for capital for my commercial business, and I want you to lend me the money."
"All right, sir. Where shall I send the money?"
"To the Ansong Market, in care of a commission merchant."
"Very well, sir. I will draw on Kim, who does the biggest commission business in the Ansong Market. You'll get the money there."
"Goodbye, sir."
When Hussein was gone, all the other guests in the room asked Bianchi why he gave so much money to a beggarly-like stranger whose family name was unknown to him. But the rich man replied with a triumphant face.
Even though he was in ragged clothes, he spoke clearly to the point without betraying shame or inferiority, unlike common people who want to borrow money for a bad debt. Such a man as he is either mad or self-confident in doing business. But judging from his dauntless eyes and booming voice, he is an uncommon man with a superhuman brain worthy of my trust. I know money and I know men. Money often makes a man small, but a man like him makes big money. I am only glad to have helped a big man do big business.
From Cardinal de Retz. Fear, which always magnifies objects, gives a body to all their fancies, which takes for its form whatever they conceive to exist in their enemies' thoughts, so that fearful persons seldom fail to fall into real inconveniences occasioned by imaginary dangers. The Duke, whose prominent character was to be always full of fear and of distrust, was, of all men I have ever seen, the most capable of falling into false steps, by the dread he had of falling into them, being in that like unto hares. From Fables by Aesop. The Boy and the Nettle. A boy, playing in the fields, got stung by a nettle. He ran home to his mother, telling her that he had but touched that nasty weed, and it had stung him.
"It was just your touching it, my boy," said the mother, "that caused it to sting you. The next time you meddle with a nettle, grasp it tightly, and it will do you no hurt. Do boldly what you do at all."
And from the Life and Letters and the Epicurean Philosophy of Ninon de L'Enclos. How to be victorious in love. But with those who have made an impression upon your heart, I have noticed that you are timid.
This quality might affect a bourgeois, but you must attack the heart of a woman of the world with other weapons. I tell you, on behalf of women, there is not one of us who does not prefer a little rough handling to too much consideration. Men lose through blundering more hearts than virtue saves. The more timidity a lover shows with us, the more it concerns our pride to goad him on. The more respect he has for our resistance, the more respect we demand of him. We would willingly say to you men, "Ah, in pity's name, do not suppose us to be so very virtuous. You are forcing us to have too much of it." We are continually struggling to hide the fact that we have permitted ourselves to be loved. Put a woman in a position to say that she has yielded only to a species of violence or to surprise. Persuade her that you do not undervalue her, and I will answer for her heart. A little more boldness on your part would put you both at your ease. Do you remember what Monsieur de La Rochefoucauld told you lately? A reasonable man in love may act like a madman, but he should not and cannot act like an idiot. The 29th Law. Plan all the way to the end. Judgment. The ending is everything. Plan all the way to it, taking into account all the possible consequences, obstacles, and twists of fortune that might reverse your hard work and give the glory to others. By planning to the end, you will not be overwhelmed by circumstances, and you will know when to stop. Gently guide fortune and help determine the future by thinking far ahead. Transgression of the law.
In 1510, a ship set out from the island of Hispaniola, now Haiti in the Dominican Republic, for Venezuela, where it was to rescue a besieged Spanish colony. Several miles out of port, a stowaway climbed out of a provision chest. Vasco Núñez de Balboa, a noble Spaniard who had come to the New World in search of gold but had fallen into debt, and had escaped his creditors by hiding in the chest. Balboa had been obsessed with gold ever since Columbus had returned to Spain from his voyages with tales of a fabulous but as yet undiscovered kingdom called El Dorado. Balboa was one of the first adventurers to come in search of Columbus's land of gold, and he had decided from the beginning that he would be the one to find it, through sheer audacity and single-mindedness. Now that he was free of his creditors, nothing would stop him. Unfortunately, the ship's owner, a wealthy jurist named Francisco Fernandez de Enciso, was furious when told of the stowaway, and he ordered that Balboa be left on the first island they came across. Before they found any island, however, Enciso received news that the colony he was to rescue had been abandoned. This was Balboa's chance. He told the sailors of his previous voyages to Panama, and of the rumors he had heard of gold in the area. The excited sailors convinced Enciso to spare Balboa's life and to establish a colony in Panama. Weeks later, they named their new settlement Darien. Darien's first governor was Enciso, but Balboa was not a man to let others steal the initiative. He campaigned against Enciso among the sailors, who eventually made it clear that they preferred him as governor. Enciso fled to Spain, fearing for his life. Months later, when a representative of the Spanish crown arrived to establish himself as the new official governor of Darien, he was turned away. On his return voyage to Spain, this man drowned. The drowning was accidental, but under Spanish law, Balboa had murdered the governor and usurped his position. Balboa's bravado had gotten him out of scrapes before, but now his hopes of wealth and glory seemed doomed. To lay claim to El Dorado, should he discover it, he would need the approval of the Spanish king, which, as an outlaw, he would never receive. There was only one solution. Panamanian Indians had told Balboa of a vast ocean on the other side of the Central American isthmus, and had said that by traveling south upon this western coast, he would reach a fabulous land of gold, called by a name that to his ears sounded like Biru. Balboa decided he would cross the treacherous jungles of Panama and become the first European to bathe his feet in this new ocean. From there, he would march on El Dorado. If he did this on Spain's behalf, he would obtain the eternal gratitude of the king and would secure his own reprieve. Only he had to act before Spanish authorities came to arrest him. In 1513, then, Balboa set out with 190 soldiers. Halfway across the isthmus, some 90 miles wide at that point, only 60 soldiers remained, many having succumbed to the harsh conditions, the blood-sucking insects, the torrential rainfall, fever. Finally, from a mountaintop, Balboa became the first European to lay eyes on the Pacific Ocean. Days later, he marched in his armor into its waters, bearing the banner of Castile and claiming all its seas, lands, and islands in the name of the Spanish throne. Indians from the area greeted Balboa with gold, jewels, and precious pearls, the like of which he had never seen. When asked where these had come from, the Indians pointed south to the land of the Incas. But Balboa had only a few soldiers left. For the moment, he decided he should return to Darien, send the jewels and gold to Spain as a token of goodwill, and ask for a large army to aid him in the conquest of El Dorado. When news reached Spain of Balboa's bold crossing of the isthmus, his discovery of the Western Ocean, and his planned conquest of El Dorado, the former criminal became a hero. He was instantly proclaimed governor of the new land. But before the king and queen received word of his discovery, they had already sent a dozen ships under the command of a man named Pedro Arias Davila, Pedrarias, with orders to arrest Balboa for murder and to take command of the colony. By the time Pedrarias arrived in Panama, he had learned that Balboa had been pardoned, and that he was to share the governorship with a former outlaw. All the same, Balboa felt uneasy. Gold was his dream. El Dorado, his only desire. In pursuit of this goal, he had nearly died many times over, and to share the wealth and glory with a newcomer would be intolerable. He also soon discovered that Pedrarius was a jealous, bitter man, and equally unhappy with the situation. Once again, the only solution for Balboa was to seize the initiative by proposing to cross the jungle with a larger army, carrying shipbuilding materials and tools. Once on the Pacific coast, he would create an armada with which to conquer the Incas. Surprisingly enough, Pedrarius agreed to the plan, perhaps sensing it would never work. Hundreds died in this second march through the jungle, and the timber they carried rotted in the torrential rains. Balboa, as usual, was undaunted. No power in the world could thwart his plan, and on arriving at the Pacific, he began to cut down trees for new lumber. But the men remaining to him were too few and too weak to mount an invasion, and once again Balboa had to return to Darien. Pedrarius had, in any case, invited Balboa back to discuss a new plan, and on the outskirts of the settlement, the explorer was met by Francisco Pizarro, an old friend who had accompanied him on his first crossing of the isthmus. But this was a trap. Leading 100 soldiers, Pizarro surrounded his former friend, arrested him, and returned him to Pedrarius, who tried him on charges of rebellion. A few days later, Balboa's head fell into a basket, along with those of his most trusted followers. Years later, Pizarro himself reached Peru, and Balboa's deeds were forgotten. Interpretation. Most men are ruled by the heart, not the head. Their plans are vague, and when they meet obstacles, they improvise. But improvisation will only bring you as far as the next crisis, and is never a substitute for thinking several steps ahead and planning to the end. Balboa had a dream of glory and wealth, and a vague plan to reach it. Yet his bold deeds and his discovery of the Pacific are largely forgotten, for he committed what in the world of power is the ultimate sin. He went part way, leaving the door open for others to take over. A real man of power would have had the prudence to see the dangers in the distance, the rivals who would want to share in the conquests, the vultures that would hover once they heard the word gold. Balboa should have kept his knowledge of the Incas secret until after he had conquered Peru. Only then would his wealth and his head have been secure. Once Pedrarius arrived on the scene, a man of power and prudence would have schemed to kill or imprison him, and to take over the army he had brought for the conquest of Peru. But Balboa was locked in the moment, always reacting emotionally, never thinking ahead. What good is it to have the greatest dream in the world if others reap the benefits and the glory? Never lose your head over a vague, open-ended dream. Plan to the end. Observance of the law. In 1863, the Prussian premier Otto von Bismarck surveyed the chessboard of European power as it then stood. The main players were England, France, and Austria. Prussia itself was one of several states in the loosely allied German Federation. Austria, dominant member of the Federation, made sure that the other German states remained weak, divided, and submissive. Bismarck believed that Prussia was destined for something far greater than servant boy to Austria. This is how Bismarck played the game. His first move was to start a war with lowly Denmark, in order to recover the former Prussian lands of Schleswig-Holstein. He knew that these rumblings of Prussian independence might worry France and England, so he enlisted Austria in the war, claiming that he was recovering Schleswig-Holstein for their benefit. In a few months after the war was decided, Bismarck demanded that the newly conquered lands be made part of Prussia. The Austrians, of course, were furious, but they compromised. First, they agreed to give the Prussians Schleswig, and a year later they sold them Holstein. The world began to see that Austria was weakening and that Prussia was on the rise. Bismarck's next move was his boldest. In 1866, he convinced King William of Prussia to withdraw from the German Federation, and in doing so to go to war with Austria itself. King William's wife, his son, the Crown Prince, and the princes of the other German kingdoms vehemently opposed such a war. But Bismarck, undaunted, succeeded in forcing the conflict, and Prussia's superior army defeated the Austrians in the brutally short 7 weeks' war. The king and the Prussian generals then wanted to march on Vienna, taking as much land from Austria as possible. But Bismarck stopped them. Now he presented himself as on the side of peace. The result was that he was able to conclude a treaty with Austria that granted Prussia and the other German states total autonomy. Bismarck could now position Prussia as the dominant power in Germany and the head of a newly formed North German Confederation. The French and the English began to compare Bismarck to Attila the Hun and to fear that he had designs on all of Europe. Once he had started on the path to conquest, there was no telling where he would stop. And indeed, 3 years later, Bismarck provoked a war with France. First, he appeared to give his permission to France's annexation of Belgium. Then, at the last moment, he changed his mind. Playing a cat-and-mouse game, he infuriated the French Emperor, Napoleon III, and stirred up his own king against the French. To no one's surprise, war broke out in 1870. The newly formed German Federation enthusiastically joined in the war on France, and once again the Prussian military machine and its allies destroyed the enemy army in a matter of months. Although Bismarck opposed taking any French land, the generals convinced him that Alsace-Lorraine would become part of the Federation. Now all of Europe feared the next move of the Prussian monster, led by Bismarck, the Iron Chancellor. And in fact, a year later, Bismarck founded the German Empire, with a Prussian king as the newly crowned emperor and Bismarck himself a prince. But then something strange happened. Bismarck instigated no more wars. And while the other European powers grabbed up land for colonies in other continents, he severely limited Germany's colonial acquisitions. He did not want more land for Germany, but more security. For the rest of his life, he struggled to maintain peace in Europe and to prevent further wars. Everybody assumed he had changed, mellowing with the years. They had failed to understand. This was the final move of his original plan. Interpretation. There is a simple reason why most men never know when to come off the attack. They form no concrete idea of their goal. Once they achieve victory, they only hunger for more. To stop, to aim for a goal and then keep to it, seems almost inhuman, in fact. Yet nothing is more critical to the maintenance of power. The person who goes too far in his triumphs creates a reaction that inevitably leads to a decline. The only solution is to plan for the long run. Foresee the future with as much clarity as the gods on Mount Olympus will look through the clouds and see the ends of all things. From the beginning of his career in politics, Bismarck had one goal, to form an independent German state led by Prussia. He instigated the war with Denmark not to conquer territory, but to stir up Prussian nationalism and unite the country. He incited the war with Austria only to gain Prussian independence. This was why he refused to grab Austrian territory. And he fomented the war with France to unite the German kingdoms against a common enemy, and thus to prepare for the formation of a united Germany. Once this was achieved, Bismarck stopped. He never let triumph go to his head, was never tempted by the siren call of more. He held the reins tightly, and whenever the generals or the king or the Prussian people demanded new conquests, he held them back. Nothing would spoil the beauty of his creation. Certainly not a false euphoria that pushed those around him to attempt to go past the end that he had so carefully planned. As Cardinal Richelieu said, experience shows that if one foresees from far away the designs to be undertaken, one can act with speed when the moment comes to execute them. Keys to Power. According to the cosmology of the ancient Greeks, the gods were thought to have complete vision into the future. They saw everything to come, right down to the intricate details. Men, on the other hand, were seen as victims of fate, trapped in the moment and their emotions, unable to see beyond immediate dangers. Those heroes, such as Odysseus, who were able to look beyond the present and plan several steps ahead, seemed to defy fate, to approximate the gods in their ability to determine the future. The comparison is still valid. Those among us who think further ahead and patiently bring their plans to fruition seem to have a godlike power. Because most people are too imprisoned in the moment to plan with this kind of foresight, the ability to ignore immediate dangers and pleasures translates into power. It is the power of being able to overcome the natural human tendency to react to things as they happen, and instead to train oneself to step back, imagining the larger things taking shape beyond one's immediate vision. Most people believe that they are, in fact, aware of the future, that they are planning and thinking ahead. They are usually deluded. What they are really doing is succumbing to their desires, to what they want the future to be. Their plans are vague, based on their imaginations rather than their reality. They may believe that they are thinking all the way to the end, but they are really only focusing on the happy ending and deluding themselves by the strength of their desire. In 415 BC, the ancient Athenians attacked Sicily, believing their expedition would bring them riches, power, and a glorious ending to the 16-year Peloponnesian War. They did not consider the dangers of an invasion so far from home. They did not foresee that the Sicilians would fight all the harder, since the battles were in their own homeland, or that all of Athens' enemies would band together against them, or that war would break out on several fronts, stretching their forces way too thin. The Sicilian expedition was a complete disaster, leading to the destruction of one of the greatest civilizations of all time. The Athenians were led into this disaster by their hearts, not their minds. They saw only the chance of glory, not the dangers that loomed in the distance. Cardinal de Retz, the 17th-century Frenchman who prided himself on his insights into human schemes and why they mostly fail, analyzed this phenomenon. In the course of a rebellion he spearheaded against the French monarchy in 1651, the young king Louis XIV and his court had suddenly left Paris and established themselves in a palace outside the capital. The presence of the king so close to the heart of the revolution had been a tremendous burden on the revolutionaries, and they breathed a sigh of relief. This later proved their downfall, however, since the court's absence from Paris gave it much more room to maneuver. "The most ordinary cause of people's mistakes," Cardinal de Retz later wrote, "is their being too much frightened at the present danger, and not enough so at that which is remote." The dangers that are remote, that loom in the distance, if we can see them as they take shape, how many mistakes we avoid. How many plans we would instantly abort if we realized we were avoiding a small danger only to step into a larger one. So much of power is not what you do, but what you do not do. The rash and foolish actions that you refrain from before they get you into trouble. Plan in detail before you act. Do not let vague plans lead you into trouble. Will this have unintended consequences? Will I stir up new enemies? Will someone else take advantage of my labors? Unhappy endings are much more common than happy ones. Do not be swayed by the happy ending in your mind. The French elections of 1848 came down to a struggle between Louis-Adolphe Thiers, the man of order, and General Louis-Eugène Cavaignac, the rabble-rouser of the right. When Thiers realized he was hopelessly behind in this high-stakes race, he searched desperately for a solution. His eye fell on Louis Bonaparte, grand-nephew of the great General Napoleon and a lowly deputy in the Parliament. This Bonaparte seemed a bit of an imbecile, but his name alone could get him elected in a country yearning for a strong ruler. He would be Thiers' puppet, and eventually would be pushed off stage. The first part of the plan worked to perfection, and Napoleon was elected by a large margin. The problem was that Thiers had not foreseen one simple fact. This imbecile was in fact a man of enormous ambition. 3 years later he dissolved Parliament, declared himself emperor, and ruled France for another 18 years, much to the horror of Thiers and his party. The ending is everything. It is the end of the action that determines who gets the glory, the money, the prize. Your conclusion must be crystal clear. You must keep it constantly in mind. You must also figure out how to ward off the vultures circling overhead, trying to live off the carcass of your creation. And you must anticipate the many possible crises that will tempt you to improvise. Bismarck overcame these dangers because he planned to the end, kept on course through every crisis, and never let others steal the glory. Once he had reached his stated goal, he withdrew into his shell like a turtle. This kind of self-control is godlike. When you see several steps ahead and plan your moves all the way to the end, you will no longer be tempted by emotion or by the desire to improvise. Your clarity will rid you of the anxiety and vagueness that are the primary reasons why so many fail to conclude their actions successfully. You see the ending, and you tolerate no deviation. Reversal. It is a cliché among strategists that your plan must include alternatives and have a degree of flexibility. That is certainly true. If you are locked into a plan too rigidly, you will be unable to deal with sudden shifts of fortune. Once you have examined the future possibilities and decided on your target, you must build in alternatives and be open to new routes toward your goal. Most people, however, lose less from overplanning and rigidity than from vagueness and a tendency to improvise constantly in the face of circumstance. There is no real purpose in contemplating a reversal to this law, then, for no good can come from refusing to think far into the future and planning to the end. If you are clear and far-thinking enough, you will understand that the future is uncertain, and that you must be open to adaptation. Only having a clear objective and a far-reaching plan allows you that freedom. Here are some further reflections on this law. From Karl von Clausewitz. There are very few men, and they are the exceptions, who are able to think and feel beyond the present moment. From a fable by Aesop. The Two Frogs. Two frogs dwelt in the same pool. The pool being dried up under the summer's heat, they left it and set out together to seek another home. As they went along, they chanced to pass a deep well, amply supplied with water, on seeing which, one of the frogs said to the other, "Let us descend and make our abode in this well. It will furnish us with shelter and food." The other replied with great caution, "But suppose the water should fail us? How can we get out again from so great a depth?" Do nothing without a regard to the consequences. From the Histories by Herodotus. Look to the end, no matter what it is you are considering. Often enough God gives a man a glimpse of happiness, and then utterly ruins him. From Caravan of Dreams by Idris Shaw. The King, the Sufi, and the Surgeon. In ancient times a king of Tartary was out walking with some of his noblemen. At the roadside was an Abdal, a wandering Sufi, who cried out, "Whoever will give me 100 dinar, I will give him some good advice." The king stopped and said, "Abdal, what is this good advice for 100 dinar? "Sir," answered the Abdal, "order the sum to be given to me, and I will tell it you immediately." The king did so, expecting to hear something extraordinary. The dervish said to him, "My advice is this. Never begin anything until you have reflected what will be the end of it." At this the nobles and everyone else present laughed, saying that the Abdal had been wise to ask for his money in advance. But the king said, "You have no reason to laugh at the good advice this Abdal has given me. No one is unaware of the fact that we should think well before doing anything. But we are daily guilty of not remembering, and the consequences are evil. I very much value this dervish's advice." The king decided to bear the advice always in his mind, and commanded it to be written in gold on the walls, and even engraved on his silver plate. Not long afterward, a plotter desired to kill the king. He bribed the royal surgeon with a promise of the prime ministership if he thrust a poisoned lancet into the king's arm. When the time came to let some of the king's blood, a silver basin was placed to catch the blood. Suddenly the surgeon became aware of the words engraved upon it. "Never begin anything until you have reflected what will be the end of it." It was only then that he realized that if the plotter became king, he could have the surgeon killed instantly, and would not need to fulfill his bargain. The king, seeing that the surgeon was now trembling, asked him what was wrong with him. And so he confessed the truth at that very moment. The plotter was seized, and the king sent for all the people who had been present when the Abdal gave his advice, and said to them, "Do you still laugh at the dervish?" From Walter Benjamin. He who asked fortune-tellers the future unwittingly forfeits an inner intimation of coming events that is 1,000 times more exact than anything they may say. The 30th Law. Make your accomplishments seem effortless. Judgment. Your actions must seem natural and executed with ease. All toil and practice that go into them, and also all the clever tricks, must be concealed. When you act, act effortlessly, as if you could do much more. Avoid the temptation of revealing how hard you work. It only raises questions. Teach no one your tricks, or they will be used against you. Observance of the Law, number 1. The Japanese tea ceremony, called cha no yu, hot water for tea, has origins in ancient times, but it reached its peak of refinement in the 16th century under its most renowned practitioner, Senno Rikyu. Although not from a noble family, Rikyu rose to great power, becoming the preferred tea master of the Emperor Hideyoshi and an important advisor on aesthetic and even political matters. For Rikyu, the secret of success consisted in appearing natural, concealing the effort behind one's work. One day Rikyu and his son went to an acquaintance's house for a tea ceremony. On the way in, the son remarked that the lovely antique-looking gate at their host's house gave it an evocatively lonely appearance. "I don't think so," replied his father. "It looks as though it had been brought from some mountain temple a long way off, and as if the labor required to import it must have cost a lot of money." If the owner of the house had put this much effort into one gate, it would show in his tea ceremony. And indeed, Senno Rikyu had to leave the ceremony early, unable to endure the affectation and effort it inadvertently revealed. On another evening, while having tea at a friend's house, Rikyu saw his host go outside, hold up a lantern in the darkness, cut a lemon off a tree, and bring it in. This charmed Rikyu. The host needed a relish for the dish he was serving and had spontaneously gone outside to get one. But when the man offered the lemon with some Osaka rice cake, Rikyu realized that he had planned the cutting of the lemon all along, to go with his expensive delicacy. The gesture no longer seemed spontaneous. It was a way for the host to prove his cleverness. He had accidentally revealed how hard he was trying. Having seen enough, Rikyu politely declined the cake, excused himself, and left. Emperor Hideyoshi once planned to visit Rikyu for a tea ceremony. On the night before he was to come, snow began to fall. Thinking quickly, Rikyu laid round cushions that fit exactly on each of the stepping stones that led through the garden to his house. Just before dawn, he rose, saw that it had stopped snowing, and carefully removed the cushions. When Hideyoshi arrived, he marveled at the simple beauty of the sight, the perfectly round stepping stones unencumbered by snow, and noticed how it called no attention to the manner in which Rikyu had accomplished it, but only to the polite gesture itself. After Senno Rikyu died, his ideas had a profound influence on the practice of the tea ceremony. The Tokugawa shogun Yorinobu, son of the great emperor Ieyasu, was a student of Rikyu's teachings. In his garden he had a stone lantern made by a famous master, and Lord Sakai Tadakatsu asked if he could come by one day to see it. Yorinobu replied that he would be honored, and commanded his gardeners to put everything in order for the visit. These gardeners, unfamiliar with the precepts of cha no yu, thought the stone lantern misshapen, its windows being too small for the present taste. They had a local workman enlarge the windows. A few days before Lord Sakai's visit, Yorinobu toured the garden. When he saw the altered windows, he exploded with rage, ready to impale on his sword the fool who had ruined the lantern, upsetting its natural grace and destroying the whole purpose of Lord Sakai's visit. When Yorinobu calmed down, however, he remembered that he had originally bought two of the lanterns, and that the second was in his garden on the Isle of Kishu. At great expense, he hired a whaleboat and the finest rowers he could find, ordering them to bring the lantern to him within 2 days, a difficult feat at best. But the sailors rowed day and night, and with the luck of a good wind they arrived just in time. To Yorinobu's delight, this stone lantern was more magnificent than the first, for it had stood untouched for 20 years in a bamboo thicket, acquiring a brilliant antique appearance and a delicate covering of moss. When Lord Sakai arrived later that same day, he was awed by the lantern, which was more magnificent than he had imagined, so graceful, and at one with the elements. Fortunately, he had no idea what time and effort it had cost Yorinobu to create this sublime effect. Interpretation. To Senno Rikyu, the sudden appearance of something naturally, almost accidentally graceful, was the height of beauty. This beauty came without warning and seemed effortless. Nature created such things by its own laws and processes, but men had to create their effects through labor and contrivance. And when they showed the effort of producing the effect was spoiled. The gate came from too far away. The cutting of the lemon looked contrived. You will often have to use tricks and ingenuity to create your effects, the cushions in the snow, the men rowing all night. But your audience must never suspect the work or the thinking that has gone into them. Nature does not reveal its tricks, and what imitates nature by appearing effortless approximates nature's power. Observance of the Law, number 2. The great escape artist Harry Houdini once advertised his act as the impossible possible. And indeed those who witnessed his dramatic escapes felt that what he did on stage contradicted common sense ideas of human capacity. One evening in 1904, an audience of 4,000 Londoners filled a theater to watch Houdini accept a challenge, to escape from a pair of manacles billed as the strongest ever invented. They contained 6 sets of locks and 9 tumblers in each cuff. A Birmingham maker had spent 5 years constructing them. Experts who examined them said they had never seen anything so intricate, and this intricacy was thought to make them impossible to escape. The crowd watched the experts secure the manacles on Houdini's wrists. Then the escape artist entered a black cabinet on stage. The minutes went by. The more time passed, the more certain it seemed that these manacles would be the first to defeat him. At one point he emerged from the cabinet and asked that the cuffs be temporarily removed so that he could take off his coat. It was hot inside. The challengers refused, suspecting his request was a trick to find out how the locks worked. Undeterred and without using his hands, Houdini managed to lift the coat over his shoulders, turn it inside out, remove a penknife from his vest pocket with his teeth, and by moving his head, cut the coat off his arms. Freed from the coat, he stepped back into the cabinet, the audience roaring with approval at his grace and dexterity. Finally, having kept the audience waiting long enough, Houdini emerged from the cabinet a second time, now with his hands free, the manacles raised high in triumph. To this day, no one knows how he managed the escape. Although he had taken close to an hour to free himself, he had never looked concerned, had shown no sign of doubt. Indeed, it seemed by the end that he had drawn out the escape as a way to heighten the drama, to make the audience worry, for there was no other sign that the performance had been anything but easy. The complaint about the heat was equally part of the act. The spectators of this and other Houdini performances must have felt he was toying with them. "These manacles are nothing," he seemed to say. "I could have freed myself a lot sooner, and from a lot worse." Over the years, Houdini escaped from the chained carcass of an embalmed sea monster, a half-octopus, half-whale-like beast that had beached near Boston. He had sealed himself inside an enormous envelope, from which he emerged without breaking the paper. He passed through brick walls. He wiggled free from straitjackets while dangling high in the air. He leaped from bridges into icy waters, his hands manacled and his legs in chains. He had himself submerged in glass cases full of water, hands padlocked, while the audience watched in amazement as he worked himself free, struggling for close to an hour, apparently without breathing. Each time he seemed to court certain death, yet survived with superhuman aplomb. Meanwhile, he said nothing about his methods, gave no clues as to how he accomplished any of his tricks. He left his audience and critics speculating, his power and reputation enhanced by their struggles with the inexplicable. Perhaps the most baffling trick of all was making a 10,000-pound elephant disappear before an audience's eyes, a feat he repeated on stage for over 19 weeks. No one has ever really explained how he did this, for in the auditorium where he performed the trick, there was simply nowhere for an elephant to hide. The effortlessness of Houdini's escapes led some to think he used occult forces, his superior psychic abilities giving him special control over his body. But a German escape artist named Kleppini claimed to know Houdini's secret. He simply used elaborate gadgets. Kleppini also claimed to have defeated Houdini in a handcuff challenge in Holland. Houdini didn't mind all kinds of speculation floating around about his methods, but he would not tolerate an outright lie. And in 1902, he challenged Kleppini to a handcuff duel. Kleppini accepted. Through a spy, he found out the secret word to unlock a pair of French combination lock cuffs that Houdini liked to use. His plan was to choose these cuffs to escape from on stage. This would definitely debunk Houdini. His genius simply lay in his use of mechanical gadgets. On the night of the challenge, just as Kleppini had planned, Houdini offered him a choice of cuffs, and he selected the ones with the combination lock. He was even able to disappear with them behind a screen to make a quick test, and re-emerge seconds later, confident of victory. Acting as if he sensed fraud, Houdini refused to lock Kleppini in the cuffs. The two men argued and began to fight, even wrestling with each other on stage. After a few minutes of this, an apparently angry, frustrated Houdini gave up and locked Kleppini in the cuffs. For the next few minutes, Kleppini strained to get free. Something was wrong. Minutes earlier, he had opened the cuffs behind the screen. Now the same code no longer worked. He sweated, racking his brains. Hours went by. The audience left. And finally, an exhausted and humiliated Kleppini gave up and asked to be released. The cuffs that Kleppini himself had opened behind the screen with the word C-L-E-F-S, French for keys, now clicked open only with the word F-R-A-U-D. Kleppini never figured out how Houdini had accomplished this uncanny feat. Interpretation. Although we do not know for certain how Houdini accomplished many of his most ingenious escapes, one thing is clear. It was not the occult or any kind of magic that gave him his powers, but hard work and endless practice, all of which he carefully concealed from the world. Houdini never left anything to chance. Day and night he studied the workings of locks, researched centuries-old sleight-of-hand tricks, pored over books on mechanics, whatever he could use. Every moment not spent researching, he spent working his body, keeping himself exceptionally limber, and learning how to control his muscles and his breathing. Early on in Houdini's career, an old Japanese performer, whom he toured with, taught him an ancient trick, how to swallow an ivory ball, then bring it back up. He practiced this endlessly with a small peeled potato tied to a string. Up and down he would manipulate the potato with his throat muscles, until they were strong enough to move it without the string. The organizers of the London Handcuff Challenge had searched Houdini's body thoroughly beforehand. But no one could check the inside of his throat, where he could have concealed small tools to help him escape. Even so, Kleppini was fundamentally wrong. It was not Houdini's tools, but his practice, work, and research that made his escapes possible. Kleppini, in fact, was completely outwitted by Houdini, who set the whole thing up. He let his opponent learn the code of the French cuffs, then baited him into choosing those cuffs on stage. Then during the two men's tussle, the dexterous Houdini was able to change the code to F-R-A-U.